What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is David A. Goldstein, author of the new book, Aliyup to Aliyah, African-American Hoopsters in the Holy Land. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinchinim Chen Dinachi, and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. You know, lately I've been thinking about the disproportionate Jewish presence in American popular music. You see, last week our guest here on Too Jewish was singer Isaac Sutton, an Israeli who popularized the Great American Songbook in Israel. Many of those songs, of course, were written by Jewish composers and lyricists like George and Ira Gershwin, Sammy Kahn, Richard Rodgers, Jerome Kern, Lorenz Hart, Julie Stein, Harold Arland, and so many more. And a week or so earlier, I saw a touring company of the Broadway musical Beautiful with my daughter, based on the songwriting and performing career of Carole King, born Carole Klein, and her lyricists and first husband, Jerry Goffin, plus their friendly competitors, the songwriting team of Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann. The show highlights the contributions of a later and equally brilliant group of Jewish songwriters associated with the Brill Building in New York. It included Neil Sedaka, Neil Diamond, Phil Spector, and Don Kirshner. Such amazing songwriting talent. And when the Nobel Prizes came out over the past couple of weeks, I was reminded that last year, in 2016, Bob Dylan improbably received the Nobel Prize for Literature. And there were many who thought if it was going to be given to a folk or rock songwriter, it could just as easily have gone to the equally Jewish Paul Simon or Leonard Cohen. And of course, there wouldn't be an American musical theater without Jewish composers, authors, and lyricists, from Irving Berlin to Rodgers and Hammerstein to Lerner and Lowe to Leonard Bernstein to Stephen Sondheim. And rock and roll, while not as obviously Jewish, includes hundreds of Jewish rock stars, from David Lee Roth to Billy Joel to Gene Simmons to Lou Reed to the Jay Giles Band to Adam Levine to Drake to Pink. And that's not to mention the producers and record moguls like Herb Alpert and David Geffen and on, or the soft pop and jazz people like Mel Torme or Barbara Streisand, Barry Manilow, Michael Bolton, Art Garfunkel, Kenny G. You get the idea. Or even recent crossover artists like Matis Yahu. Anyway, I was thinking about the incredible influence Jewish songwriters have had on American popular music over the past century. In addition to having established entire genres of music and produced some of the most clearly identified American songs, you know, like Take Me Out to the Ball Game or God Bless America, we Jews have been central to the development of many of the most uniquely American musical expressions that there are. There are certainly other ethnic groups in America who contributed heavily, African Americans, of course, and Italian Americans among them, but considering our small numerical representation in the American population, it is stunning to realize just how extensive Jewish contributions to popular music in our country have been, and still are. Perhaps that's because music has been at the heart of the Jewish experience of the world throughout our long history. We don't really speak our prayers or read Torah. Instead, we sing our liturgy and chant our sacred scriptures. Historically, we have special modes for every different part of each service, varying on the Sabbath and festivals. And practically, we have lived in every country on earth, we Jews, and learned and synthesized the musical traditions we heard in all of them into some parts of our own Jewish musical practices. That's not to say that Jews are all good at music. Although, for a very long time, we had all the best violinists, many of the best pianists, and we owned the clarinet. But it is to say that music is a part of our soul as a people, and expressing it in new and creative ways, adapting and adopting new styles and practices in music, being innovative and courageous in our use of them, well, it all came very easily to Jews. And it still does. Thank goodness. To play us in this morning on that theme, here's a classic from the early days of immigration to America, the Grüne Cousine, about a newcomer, a greenhorn or greener, to Columbus's country, as sung by the Barry sisters.
Für mir ist die Kimmener Cousine, schön die kolde Siege, wenn die Grüne, Bäckerlach wie reutet Pomeranzen. Bäckerlach, die reutsche Pomeranzen. Bäckerlach, was beten sich zum Tanzen. Kerlach, die goldene Gelockte. Sängerlach, die Perlach getockte. Egerlach, die Teiberlach hat Zwilling. Lippalach, Karschalach in Frühling, Egerlach wie Teiberlach hat Zwilling, Lippalach wie Karschalach in Frühling. Sie ist nicht gegangen, nur gespringen, sie hat nicht gerät, sie hat gesingen. Ach so, ja, sah sie gewinn die Grüne, in Duss ist sie gewesen, mein Cousin. So ja sah sie gewesen, die Grüne. In Duss ist sie gewesen, mein Cousine. Die Grüne hat der Boy sich schön gefunden. Er hat bei ihr die Päde zu genommen. Uiuiuiui, sie hat ruhige Erzünde. Er hat ja hat der Weib mit wenig Kinder. Oh, ihr sie hat ruhige Erzünder. Er hat ja hat der Weib mit wenig Kinder. Jetzt darf ich vergegen mein Cousine. Frag ich ihr, was machst die etwas Grüne? Empfert sie mir mit der ruhig Miene. Als ein Mann auf Columbus ist mit Biene. Empfert sie mir mit der ruhig Miene. Als ein Mann auf Columbus ist mit Biene.
That was the Barry sisters singing Grüne Cousine. Their real names, by the way, were Minnie and Clara Bagelman. Just because Jews could make it in American music does not mean they didn't change their names along the way, of course. Our guest this morning, David A. Goldstein, author of Alley-Oop to Aliyah, African-American Hoopsters in the Holy Land, has traced a remarkable phenomenon in a very entertaining way. Find out why black American basketball players have become Israeli stars and often Israeli citizens, how that's changed a whole culture, when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
The Tucson J has something for everyone. Open to all, the J serves the entire Tucson community with an enriching early childhood education and after-school J care program and robust state-of-the-art fitness center, arts and culture classes, sports and recreation, and much more. The J is not just a gym. We offer Jewish programs and holiday celebrations, concerts, lectures, and a beautiful sculpture garden and fine art gallery. The J provides a Hamish atmosphere steeped in Jewish identity and values. Stop by, take a tour, and see what we have to offer. The Tucson J, 3800 East River Road, or TucsonJCC.org.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. David Goldstein has a new book out, Alley-Oop to Aliyah, African-American Hoopsters in the Holy Land, which is my personal favorite for the best title of a book this year so far. Tell us a little bit about how you got interested in this and how the book evolved.
Sure. Well, I was in Israel. This is more than 10 years ago now, amazingly enough, visiting family and specifically my grandparents. And they had some of their friends over in a seniors living complex in Jerusalem. And I mentioned being from Toronto, and this group of, senior Eastern European Jewish women who I wouldn't have guessed for sports fans at all, found out I was from Toronto and immediately went bananas about Anthony Parker. And Anthony Parker, if you're not familiar, was an NBA player at the time for the Toronto Raptors. So that was the connection to Toronto. But he had played 5 years at Maccabi Tel Aviv in Israel, and they couldn't say enough about him, not even so much as a player, but as a person. And they called him a Ziskite and a Mensch and Oy Zis and on and on. And it just completely struck a chord with me that, this unusual cohort of sports fans really fell in love with this African-American player and held him in such high esteem. And it got me thinking about basketball in Israel and African-Americans there in particular. And what I discovered from that point on was a deepening phenomenon that really struck a chord with me and made me quite curious about all of it. And that's ultimately what started the research process and led to this book.
For those of us who've lived in Israel, it's easy to understand the Israeli mania for Kadursal, for basketball. But it's a little hard for Americans, even those who love hoops, it's an American game after all, to appreciate the incredible passion of Israeli basketball fans. It's the second sport in Israel, I think, after soccer.
Yeah, exactly right. And it's the second sport as far as popularity or participation, but it's the first sport as far as actual success on an international stage.
Boy, is that ever true.
Yeah, exactly. And as you say, if you've been to Israel, it's a country that gets so heavily criticized in so many ways and from so many directions that any sort of national success on an international stage is embraced at an extreme level, and you mentioned the mania, and it's accurate. And so, Maccabi Tel Aviv is the top team in Israel, and in the late 70s, following Yom Kippur War in 73, following the Munich massacre at the Olympics, and all these negative news stories, it was Maccabi Tel Aviv winning a European championship in 1977 and beating CSKA Moscow, a Russian team of all things that represented the Russian army. It really was a unifying moment, and Tal Brody, a famous American Jewish player, said, "We're on the map and we're staying on the map." And it became this really unifying quote. But one of the best players on that team was Alcee Perry, an African-American player from Newark, New Jersey, who ended up, falling in love with the country, staying, converting to Judaism, and he lives there to this day. And he really was at the forefront of this. But it was a unifying moment that wouldn't have happened without this player from New Jersey with no discernible connection to the country other than a basketball dream.
In the interest of full disclosure, I was in Israel when they won that championship, just happened to be there on a trip with my parents, and the country went insane. It was such a positive, wild experience. Kind of the way America did when the miracle on ice against the Russian hockey team. It was like that, but more so.
Yeah, and there's amazing stories about how fanatic that, Israel at the time had one television channel. So when Maccabi Tel Aviv played, the whole country was watching.
Right.
And there were warnings about, turn off your refrigerator and turn off all your other electrical appliances because we're going to have a national blackout because so many fans are watching on their TVs. We're going to run out of electricity.
Right.
That's how unifying it was. And you didn't need to be a basketball fan. It was an Israeli moment. It just happened to take place on a basketball court.
So, and we'll talk much more about particularly the African-American role in all of this when we come back with David Goldstein in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Jarrow Psych specializes in providing short-term, inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website. Streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Eastern Europe under the Soviet Union, under the, you know, the whole Eastern Bloc, Iron Curtain countries where religion was prevented officially or allowed only in very small ways. When it began to revive after the fall of the Soviet Union, the first people on the ground almost always were Lubavitch, were the Chabad groups. There have been some exceptions, but that's really sort of where all of those Jewish communities began to revive. You've been many of those places. Let's talk kind of generically about how all of that happened and what it's led to.
Right. Great idea. I think first you might want to tell your listeners that Chabad is an acronym and explain what it stands
right.
for.
Chachma Bina Dea. It actually is a group that there are many different Hasidic groups. Chabad is the one that people know. Because they have the most outreach-oriented one, oriented approach. Rabbi Schneerson was the great, there was a sort of hereditary dynasty of Schneersons. Lubavitch is the place where they originally came from in Eastern Europe. And after World War II and the Holocaust, Chabad, which was just one of many Hasidic groups, became the first one to actively embrace outreach and embrace technology as a means of reaching Jews who were no longer connected, and it's now become a worldwide movement with this concept of shlichut, representatives going. Many people, of course, know it because there's a free Chabad where you can go, and they do services, and everybody is always welcome. It's an interesting group, and because of this notion of service, in which the rabbis basically serve and have to raise their own salaries wherever they're sent, they've been able to send emissaries literally all over the world into almost every community, no matter what the original religious orientation was with this Eastern European
Not to mention
approach.
College campuses here in the U.S.
Right. Almost every college campus has a Chabad house now, sometimes a secondary or third Chabad presence.
And
as
apart
well as
from
other
Eastern
Jewish
Europe,
presence.
Which I promise to get right back to,
sure.
You know, every Israeli who does international travel after military service, whether they take the South American route,
almost every Israeli,
right,
might
or
add.
Southeast Asia or wherever,
right.
They know that whether it's in Bangkok or Lima, Peru, wherever, there's going to be a Chabad house that celebrates every Friday night and every Jewish holiday, and particularly that has an open community seder that anyone can go to. You don't have to pay.
I think the biggest
get a good
one
meal,
in the world
you're
is
get...
in Kathmandu. I mean, it's stunning.
Right. So, you know, in some of these places, Chabad serves almost like a youth hostel where the programming is all Jewish. But in Eastern Europe, I mean, you're right that like right after the fall of communism, in the capitals of all these re-emerged independent countries like Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, et cetera, et cetera. However big or small the Jewish community was, Chabad sent usually a rabbi and a rebbetzin, sometimes with several small children.
And if they didn't start with them, they soon had them.
Right. To become the nucleus of a reborn Jewish community and to organize community life and services and Jewish festivals and Sabbaths and whatever. And it's remarkable how quick, how adaptable, and how universal this was in all these places in Central and Eastern Europe. And, you know, it may or may not be fair, but we should probably compare other streams of Judaism and what they've done or not done to what Chabad has done.
Absolutely. I think that's a great subject. Just sort of continuing this thought about, like, what does Jewish outreach mean and how has it affected many places around the world? Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome Oshrat Barel, our Mevinah on Israel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So Yitzhak Rabin, his memory be a blessing, is a very important figure in world history and Jewish history. But in Israel, it's unique. The date that he was assassinated or approximately has become a national holiday. Tell us about that, because I don't think people here realize that.
Yeah, it was like 95. So it's like
I remember where I was when he was shot. You know, it's incredible.
Where were you?
I was in Charleston, South Carolina, meeting with a group from the Reform Movement about getting my congregation into the Reform Movement. It had been in the Conservative Movement. And I was in a hotel, believe it or not, in Charleston, and the news came on, and it was like, it's like remembering where you were at 9/11. It's the same kind of experience.
Yeah. So I was like so close to the, we lived in Tel Aviv back then, and we literally heard the shoots from our house.
So you were close to what's now Rabin Square,
and
then
we didn't have a clue what's happening. Then
Kings of Israel.
On the news, and then we saw on the news, and then, you know, it was, it took like a few hours until we really, Eitan Haber back then, you know, went to the news and he said, Yitzhak Rabin Einenu. It was like, oh my God, I think
he was kind of the Walter Cronkite of Israel in those days.
It's 23 years now, I think, right?
Yes, 22 years.
Sorry.
Years, yeah.
Yeah, and I still remember when it came to the news and how we felt. And then, you know, everyone called everyone and it was like, at the beginning, it was like crazy on a personal level. And then we started to understand on a national level. Oh, my God, political. I was like very, very young. I was like 20 or 21.
Right.
So it was like I didn't fully understand at the beginning, but definitely, you know, days after and weeks after, and you know, we understand what a terrible situation and what a tipping point of a nation. You know, it's one thing that you have so many enemies around you and you need to deal with, but from someone from the inside, from your house, from your home, you know, it's break all the laws of you know. Having a arvut hadadit, talking to each other, finding, how can you bridge outside if you can't bridge inside, you know?
Right.
That was, I think, and a lot of organizations in Israel were established because of
Rabin's assassination.
Zionism 2000 by Roni Dweck, you know, it's now a big and very impactful organization in Israel, but he was this organization born from the need of, you know, having like dialogue among all the different streams in Israel, you know, kochenu beachdutenu, you know,
I don't
know how to translate.
Yeah, it has to be strengthen our fellowship, our brotherhood, our understanding of one nation, Am Yisrael, you know, Am Echad.
And it's not just phrases that it's nice to have on your whatever, on your, the back of your car. It's like, it's that's the real, you know, if you are not meuchadim,
we're not unified.
So it's very easy to beat us.
You know, I think the greatest shock, of course, was that this was a Jewish terrorist who killed Rabin, that he did it because he didn't believe in the Oslo process, that they felt we were giving too much. Israel was giving too much to the Palestinians. And I think that was the great shock for all of us.
Nahon.
If Rabin had been killed.
Guy, a student, like a law student.
A smart guy.
A smart guy from Bar-Ilan, from a normative family, you know.
How could this possibly happen?
And not
somebody mentally unhinged, actually. It was politically motivated.
Yeah.
Well, I hope we've learned something in these 22 years, and I hope Israel has learned something over that time, too. Thanks, Ashrat.
Toda.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
When we come back here on Too Jewish, we'll get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. This joke was recently told by, of all people, Vladimir Putin. An Israeli general is reviewing the troops, and he stops in front of one young soldier and asks him, "If you see 20 terrorists coming towards you, what would you do?" "I would take an Uzi and shoot them," the soldier replies. "Good," the general answers. "And what if a tank was coming at you?" "I'd take a rocket launcher and defend myself," the soldier answers. "Right. And if there's a plane overhead that comes down to strafe you, well, then I'd fire a surface-to-air missile at it," the Israeli soldier replies. And the general finally asks, "And what if you see planes, tanks, and terrorists attacking together?" The young soldier replies, "General, am I the only one in this army?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Vayera in Genesis, which includes the great and terrible story of the binding of Isaac, the Akedah. God tests Abraham by having him almost, but not quite, sacrifice Isaac on a rock. Famous for being read on Rosh Hashanah annually, its connection would seem to be the fact that a ram appears at the end of the story, caught in a thicket by its horns, the model for all future shofars. But this passage is much more than a mere animal tale. Cryptic yet oddly repetitive, it raises a host of painful moral dilemmas, challenges us to think intensely about just what our relationship to God truly is. According to the text, God tests Abraham, Adonai Nisayet Avram, by commanding him to sacrifice his son, his only beloved son, Isaac. This triple identification of Isaac mirrors an earlier command in the Torah portion of Lech Lecha. Abraham is told to begin his great journey towards God and monotheism by leaving his land, his birthplace, and his father's home. Now, to balance it, he's being told to kill your son, your only son, your beloved son. There are problems in the text here. Abraham actually has another older son, Ishmael. Isaac is not truly his only son. Isaac is actually the son of his older age with his wife Sarah. Isaac is Sarah's only son. Clearly, all God needs to say is, "Take your son Isaac, and there'll be no doubt who is intended for the sacrificial altar." Why all this extra language? But the biggest problem in the text is a simple fact that Abraham, who has shown a tendency to argue and fight injustice, obeys this terrible command of God and does so with apparent alacrity, relish. He doesn't make a peep, doesn't say a single word of objection to God. In fact, he gets up especially early in the morning in order to fulfill this horrible command with energy. The narrative itself sets up the drama beautifully, painfully, tragically. Isaac goes along with his father. The phrase, "the two walked on together," is repeated and finally asks, "Where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham replies, correctly but ironically, "God will provide." It is a weird, deeply troubling scene. And then, as Abraham is about to slaughter his son, an angel of God intervenes, and the murder of the innocent, the sacrifice of Isaac, is stopped. Isaac lives, and the future of our people, Abraham's children, is preserved. This story in its place and time was undoubtedly a polemical tale designed to teach the prohibition on human sacrifice. Children are not meant to be slaughtered on the altar of their parents' beliefs. God does not want the blood of the human lamb. Our Lord does not truly desire the destruction of his own children. God desires life. Other religions have carried this Akedah story to a different, bloodier, even more horrible conclusion, believing that human sacrifice and suffering are the essential elements in religious life. But the story of the binding of Isaac makes it clear that killing our own kids, the glorification of the loss of a child, will never be acceptable to Jews. In fact, Abraham's urgent rush to fulfill God's weird and painful command to kill his son reminds us that we can embrace morally bad decisions with great fervor. Many, many times in human history, we have sent our children off to die for causes that were far from right. The great World War I poet Wilfred Owen paraphrased this theme in his verse, The Parable of the Old Man and the Young. So Abram rose and clave the wood and went and took the fire with him and a knife. And as they journeyed, both of them together, Isaac the firstborn spake and said, My father, behold the preparations, fire and iron, but where the lamb for this burnt offering? Then Abram bound the youth with belts and straps and builded parapets and trenches there, and stretched forth the knife to slay his son, when, lo, an angel called him out of heaven, saying, Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do anything to him thy son. Behold, caught in a thicket by its horns a ram. Offer the ram of pride instead. But the old man would not do so, but slew his son and half the seed of Europe, one by one. Wilfred Owen's poem about this story of the binding of Isaac set in the context of the brutality of World War I. You know, we still engage in such choices. Like Abraham, we still fail the test of protecting our children too often. May we learn from this Akedah test of Abraham's to choose life and not sacrifice for our own children. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, David A. Goldstein, author of a fun and charming new book about African-American basketball stars in Israel, will tell us how this became an important part of Israeli culture to the mutual benefit of everybody. Find out when we come back in a moment right here on Too Jewish.
The Tucson J has something for everyone. Open to all, the J serves the entire Tucson community with an enriching early childhood education and after-school J care program and robust state-of-the-art fitness center, arts and culture classes, sports and recreation, and much more. The J is not just a gym. We offer Jewish programs and holiday celebrations, concerts, lectures, and a beautiful sculpture garden and fine art gallery. The J provides a Hamish atmosphere steeped in Jewish identity and values. Stop by, take a tour, and see what we have to offer. The Tucson J, 3800 East River Road, or TucsonJCC.org.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from our guest, Rabbi Sandy Seltzer.
Dozens of experts from the field of nuclear physics, security, and diplomacy from countries around the world have met in Paris to discuss ways and means of advancing nuclear disarmament. The meeting, held under the auspices of the International Luxembourg Forum on Preventing Nuclear Catastrophe, was founded and is chaired by Moshe Kantor, a Russian Jew, who also serves as president of the European Jewish Congress and the European Council on Tolerance and Reconciliation. Pointing to the growing tensions between the United States and North Korea, India and Pakistan, as well as problems with Iran, the group, which meets each year in a different world capital, warned that the risk of nuclear war was greater today than it has been at any time since the end of the Cold War. The government of Israel has given official approval to a delegation of top Israeli business persons to travel to Cuba for the purpose of promoting trade with government-owned companies in that nation, even though Jerusalem and Havana do not have formal diplomatic relations. Scheduled for early December, the junket was organized by the Israel Latin American Chamber of Commerce. Although this is the first time there has been official sponsorship of such a visit, individual Israelis have been doing business in Cuba for many years. After multiple expressions of anger from readers, former White House Director of Communications Anthony Scaramucci removed a survey which had been posted on Twitter, which asked how many Jews were killed during the Holocaust. Adding to the outrage, the survey offered multiple choices as the answer, none of which included the actual number who had died of 6 million. In his apology for doing so, Scaramucci explained that the survey had been intended solely for the purpose, in his words, of raising awareness of what had happened. He pledged a $25,000 gift to the Simon Wiesenthal Center. The National Football League has prepared a new film soon to be shown on the NFL Network called Touchdown in Israel. The film features such football greats as Joe Montana, Jim Brown, Marshall Faulk, and Dave Casper, who are among 18 Hall of Famers who came to Israel and toured the country. The week-long Goodwill Mission was hosted and sponsored by the owner of the world champion New England Patriots, Robert Kraft of Boston. Kraft also endowed the construction of what has been named the Kraft Family Sports Complex near Jerusalem, a facility which will include the first full-size football field in the country in hopes of stirring interest and participation in the sport among Israelis. And that's the Two Jewish News.
We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, David Goldstein, has written a really fun and fascinating book, Alley-Oop to Aliyah, African-American Hoopsters in the Holy Land. You know, we were talking earlier about that first championship, Euro championship for Israel, and how everybody went nuts. And I can remember that, you know, it was just a wild experience, but it was fueled in part because of a strange rule that you can have a certain number of non-national professionals. Can you explain how all that works?
Sure. So as you can imagine, when the Israeli Basketball League started, it was entirely Israelis. And as Maccabi Tel Aviv started competing in Europe, other countries in Europe allowed for a limited number of foreigners to kind of increase the talent level. And so Israel went from, you know, just Israelis to allowing every team one foreign player. And what took place shortly after that was teams started to find loopholes. And in Israel, a very unique loophole existed, which is the law of return, which you're familiar with, and I suspect your listeners are as well.
Of course, anybody Jewish can go back. One Jewish grandparent is all you need, and then that makes you an Israeli, kind of an instant Israeli.
Exactly. So, and with becoming an instant Israeli, you're no longer counted against that one foreigner maximum. And so now you can have a very talented player if they're Jewish, and you can bring in another American. So what ended up happening in the late 70s and into the early to mid 80s were a lot of players, African-American players, converting to Judaism and coming to play in Israel as Israelis, opening up those extra roster spots. Now, some of those conversions were very legitimate, and these were players that had experiences in Israel that changed them and led them to want to follow a new path spiritually. And I've spoken to players who've said very clearly this is legit, and I continue to practice as a Jew today. And some were less legitimate. And there were horror stories reported in the papers of, you know, Israeli teams paying American rabbis to have 15-minute meetings with players across the U.S. and kind of tap them on the shoulder and say, okay, you're Jewish now, I'll send in a certificate. And so it was a really interesting time because in addition to there were conversions and then there were sketchy marriages. And so you'd have African-American players marry 60-something-year-old women in a quick ceremony in Cyprus and then fly back to Israel and say, you know, I've married a Jew, I'd like my citizenship. So there were some creative uses of the law of return, and that really kind of sped the process up and took it from, you know, one foreign player, quite frequently an African-American player, per team to suddenly by the mid-80s you had a handful on each team. And so that really kind of spurred the process and accelerated it. But even since they've closed those loopholes and required kind of a certain number of years in the country, the phenomenon continues, and it continues to be a very, very popular place for African-American players.
You know, when I was in Israel, and I keep going back to that great first championship, I'd been in Israel for Entebbe the year before. It just happened I was a 15-year-old kid, and everybody went crazy, but I think people went crazier for basketball. The African-American players, I think people may be most familiar with kind of the most recent Amari Stoudemire. That's kind of a different situation. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. Amari's has a very unique backstory and a very unique identity. And so he first arrived in Israel as a visitor in 2010, and very little was known about what drew him there. And people kind of speculated, and some comments were made, and there was a theory that he was Jewish, And he's been back a few times. So he went back in 2013, and then he bought a team in Israel in 2015, and he played all of last year there. And his identity and kind of quotes about his identity have changed a bit over time. But ultimately, it appears that Amari was raised a black Hebrew Israelite. And this is a community that considers itself a descendant of the lost tribes, and so aren't traditionally considered Jewish, and different communities have different specifics, but Amari keeps the Jewish Sabbath. He doesn't eat meat and milk. He doesn't eat pork or shellfish, but he also accepts, or his church accepts Jesus as the Messiah. And so it's a complicated identity, but it's a very interesting example of a much larger community. And there's a Black Hebrew Israelite community in Dimona in Israel that originated in Chicago. So, you know, and I say in the book, you could write a PhD dissertation just on that community and his role in it. But it is an interesting example of, it's not as simple as saying Jewish or not, or, you know, what's your identity in a one-word answer. Amari's example and quite a few others show that there's a lot of nuance and a lot of complexity to it, and basketball is an interesting way, I think, of telling people about that and educating some people about that.
Who was your favorite figure that you interviewed for this? You've done so many profiles. I should have mentioned you've done profiles of NBA players for years in your own work. You've taught sports journalism. You've taught law. I mean, you've done a lot of stuff in sports. Who was your favorite one that you interviewed in preparing this book?
You know, it's really tough to pinpoint one. The players were so extraordinarily open and generous with their time and with their, frankly, with their disclosure. I mean, I this is a basketball book, but I was asking about personal life, religious identity. You know, how did you meet your wife? How are you raising your kids? Because a lot of these players, you know, I mentioned Alcee Perry from that 1977 team, but a lot of players continue to really make Aliyah and continue their lives in Israel. And I was curious about all aspects. So, you know, I interviewed more than 40 players for this book, and they were all extraordinary. You know, one example that kind of stands out is a player named Fred Campbell. He's not the most famous of the players. He played a lot of his career in the second and third division in Israel. But this is a guy who played elsewhere in Europe. His agent called him, you know, more than 25 years ago and said, I have an opportunity for you in Israel. He said, I don't want to go there. You know, I hear about the violence. I hear about the conflict. I'm concerned. The agent said, look, Fred, go for 4 days. Give me 4 days. And if you don't like it, I'll fly you out and we'll send you somewhere else. And Fred Campbell's lived there for more than 25 years. He converted to Judaism. He's served in the army. His son will serve in the army. He jokes with me about, you know, his friends coming over and him correcting them about his dairy and his meat, forks and knives. I mean, it's a really extraordinary example where someone didn't want to spend even 3 days in Israel, had to have their arm twisted, and now identifies fully as an Israeli and is really an extraordinary transformation and a great example of a phenomenon that really affects many more players than just him. But that's one that really stands out.
We talk about sports being a universal language, but the truth is, when you're communicating on the court, you need to use words. Is language a barrier at times for these guys?
Very rarely. It's interesting. It's one of the kind of first things that players mention as a reason that the transition is so easy for them in Israel. They talk about the warmth of the Israeli people and the family-oriented nature of the people there. But one of the big factors is everyone speaks English. And not only do they speak English, they want to speak English. It's a very pro-American country, and speaking English is a point of pride. So it's funny because a lot of players, even the ones that stay there for many years, don't pick up Hebrew as well as one might think or as well as they might hope.
Because everybody talks to them in English, right?
Exactly. So it comes up occasionally. It came up, you know, the media is quite zealous in covering teams, and there were some players who noted, you know, some things get lost in translation, or a comment made quietly in English would be, you know, a big Hebrew headline in the Hebrew newspapers, and they wouldn't know what it said. So they'd show up to practice thinking, you know, nothing was wrong, and they'd find out there was some controversy. But it's a really minor point, and it barely came up. Generally speaking, everyone spoke English, and there are some good anecdotes in the book as well about those players that do try to speak Hebrew and learn Hebrew and how their experiences went.
You know, Israel is a diverse society. There are people from all over the world. Jews come from 180 countries or something and look different. But still, being a really tall black guy in Israel must be a strange experience at first.
Interesting. I thought so as well when I started this project at the outset. And a lot of players said that they fit in better there than in a lot of places they would play overseas. Now, obviously, they might stand out more than in their home communities, but... You know, players that I spoke to played in Russia and Hungary and Poland and all sorts of different countries that between physical differences and language differences, they did have that feeling. And generally speaking, the feeling that they gave about Israel was that they fit in quite well. You know, they were definitely treated like celebrities. You know, there's something about a star athlete choosing to play in Israel that's really embraced. By the people there, I think in part, again, because it is such a criticized country elsewhere. But the players mentioned that there are Ethiopian Jews, there are Black Hebrew Israelites. You know, there's people from all over the Middle East where the skin tone does tend to be a bit darker. And so from their perspective, it may not be America, but it's a much simpler transition and a much easier transition than in a lot of other places where they would go to play.
What was the most surprising thing you discovered in preparing your book?
The most surprising was probably the only real negative that came out. And there, you know, there's bound to be some negative aspects. Nothing can be perfect or expected to be perfect. But I was surprised that a lot of the players that made their lives in Israel and you know, that retired thereafter playing, while they were embraced as players and they're embraced in their communities and societies, they struggled to find coaching jobs after they retired. And so the consensus that I heard from the players that have retired and stayed was, you know, we can get coaching jobs in the second division or in the third division, so the minor leagues. We can get coaching jobs coaching youth and developmental basketball. But very, very few examples of retired players getting coaching jobs in the first division. And some were reluctant to point to race as a factor for that. Some were clear and just said, you know, I can't think of anything else it would be. And to me, that's a challenge and an area, an opportunity for improvement. You know, and they all still say overall the experience is fantastic. Overall, there's very little racism that they experience. But... it's a pretty notable issue. Derek Sharp coached for a couple of years as an assistant at Maccabi Tel Aviv. Willie Sims coached for 1 year as an assistant. But these are players that were stars in college that spent 15 or 20 years playing at high levels all across Europe. Tons of basketball knowledge. And as one player said, quite simply, you know, you've got six black players on the court or on your bench. It makes sense to have a black player on your sideline. And so that was a surprise to me. I did not expect it. And you know, if one player had said it, it would have been one thing. But it really was one player after another to the point of, you know, five, six or seven guys that were all expressing similar sentiments.
So, I mean, it does seem like an area for potential growth. It's not as though that happened quickly in America, of course, even when the game is substantially African-American here. But maybe the next David Blatt is African-American and just hasn't been picked yet.
Exactly. I think it's an untapped source of basketball knowledge. And, you know, you talk about the next David Blatt. Well, you know, they might help develop the next Omri Caspi. And I spoke to Caspi and got some great comments from him about how much he learned from African-American players and their commitment to the game and their work ethic. And a lot of these players have played in the NBA. So, you know, the young next generation of Israeli talent can learn from these retired players, frankly, things that they can't learn from local Israelis. There is another level that they've played at, and it can help grow that next generation.
We certainly hope so. The book is delightful, Alley-Oop to Aliyah, African-American Hoopsters in the Holy Land. You can find it, of course, on Amazon. Where else can people go to find out more about you or about the book?
Well, alleyooptoaliyah.com is the best place. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, you know, and hoping to get the word out and agreed. It's, you know, it's an amazing phenomenon. These players are extraordinary. They shared so much of their lives, and I'm very excited for everyone to get a chance to read and hear about really an extraordinary group of ambassadors of the country. So I'm quite happy for them that their story will be getting out there now.
David, thank you so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest will be Rotem Malach of the World Zionist Organization, speaking about a very important but not well-known institution, the Israeli Supreme Court. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from Israeli singer Eyal Golan, his song Tavoi Hayom. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Tavoi Hayom, an lo yachol lishon, alev rotze lachlom, kvar chatziti et gvulot ha-igayon, kshat lo kan, ani shuv lo nirdam, ulai titni siman, boi tiri kol haklafim al ha-shulchan, tavoi Hayom. תבואי היום, השמש בחלון, יש בליבי מקום בשבילך גם עד יומי האחרון, זה לא נגמר, תודי גם לך נשאר, נשכח את העבר, נצייר לנו מחר, אם רק תבואי אליי, תאמרי לי שלום, ספרי במבט, תשאירי מקום, בואי תקחי לי את השקט, ואם את לא יודעת מתי, תבואי היום, אל תהי לי קשה, את כמו יעלון, שוב לא אתן לך ללכת. תבואי היום. שארת אצלי חיוך תבואי אליי דחוף בלעדייך קר לי גם בתוך הפוך הלב נפתח שום רגש לא יברח אוהב אותך כל כך בלעדייך עוד שנייה אני אצרח תבואי היום בואי אליי תאמרי לי שלום ספרי במבט תשאירי מקום בואי תקחי השקט ואם את לא יודעת מתי תבואי היום אל תהי לי קשה את כמו יעלום שוב לא אתן לך ללכת תבואי היום נגשים לנו חלום רק אני ואת פתאום בואי נברח סתם עוד היום תבואי היום אל תגידי לי מחר זה מרגיש לי מאוחר והלב עדיין שר בואי אליי תאמרי לי שלום ספרי במבט תשאירי מקום בואי תקחי לי את השקט ואם את לא יודעת מתי תבואי היום אל תהי לי קשה את כמו יעלום שוב לא אתן לך ללכת תבואי היום
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.